Hans Andersen's Fairy Tales, First Series, Preface. The Hans Andersen Fairy Tales will be read in schools and homes as long as there are children who love to read. As a storyteller for children, the author has no rival in power to enlist the imagination and carry it along natural, healthful lines. The power of his tales to charm and elevate runs like a living thread through whatever he writes. In the two books in which they are here presented, they have met the test and held an undiminishing popularity among the best children's books. They are recognized as standards, and as juvenile writings come to be more carefully standardized, their place in permanent literature will grow wider and more secure. A few children's authors will be ranked among the immortals, and Hans Andersen is one of them. Denmark and Finland supply the natural background for the quaint fancies and growing genius of their gifted son, who was storyteller, playwright, and poet in one. Love of nature, love of country, fellow feeling with life in everything, and a wonderful gift for investing everything with life raw together to produce in him a character whose spell is in all his writings. The story of my life is perhaps the most thrilling of all of them. Recognized in courts of kings and castles of nobles, he recited his little stories with the same simplicity by which he had made them familiar in cottages of the peasantry, and endeared himself alike to all who listened. These attributes, while they do not account for his genius, help us to unravel the charm of it. The simplest of the stories meet Ruskin's requirement for a child's story, they are sweet and sad. From most writers who have contributed largely to children's literature, only a few selected gems are likely to gain permanence. With Andersen, the case is different. While there are such gems, the greater value lies in taking these stories as a type of literature and living in it a while, through the power of cumulative reading. It is not too much to say that there is a temper and spirit in Andersen which is all his own, a simple philosophy which continuous reading is sure to impart. For this reason, these are good books for a child to own. An occasional rereading will inspire in him a healthy, normal taste in reading. Many of the stories are of value to read to very young children. They guide an exuberant imagination along natural channels. The text of the present edition is a reprint of an earlier one which was based upon a sentence-by-sentence comparison of the 4 or 5 translations current in Europe and America. It has been widely commended as enjoyable reading, while faithful to the letter and spirit of the Danish original. A slight abridgment has been made in 2 of the longer stories. The order of the selections adapts the reading to the growing child. The first series should be sufficiently easy for children of about 8 or 9 years old. J. H. Stickney, Contents, Page, The Fir Tree 1, Little T.U.K. 20. The Ugly Duckling 30, Little Idas Flowers 52, The Steadfast Tin Soldier 67, Little Thumbelina 77, Sunshine Stories 101, T.H.E. Darning Needle 109, The Little Match Girl 117, The Loving Pair 124, The Leaping Match 129, The Happy Family 134, The G.R.E.E.N.I.S. 141, O.L.E.L.U.K.O.I.E., The Dream God 145, The Money Box 169, Elder Tree Mother 174, The Snow Queen 192, The Roses and the Sparrows 253, The Old House 273, The Conceited Apple Branch 290, Notes 299, Hans Andersen's Fairy Tales, The Fir Tree, Far Away in the Forest, where the warm sun and the fresh air made a sweet resting place, grew a pretty little fir tree. The situation was all that could be desired. And yet the tree was not happy. It wished so much to be like its tall companions, the pines and firs which grew around it. The sun shone, and the soft air fluttered its leaves, and the little peasant children passed by, prattling merrily. But the fir tree did not heed them. Sometimes the children would bring a large basket of raspberries or strawberries, wreathed on straws, and seat themselves near the fir tree, and say, "Is it not a pretty little tree?" Which made it feel even more unhappy than before. And yet all this while the tree grew a notch or joint taller every year, for by the number of joints in the stem of a fir tree we can discover its age. Still, as it grew, it complained, "Oh, how I wish I were as tall as the other trees. Then I would spread out my branches on every side, and my crown would overlook the wide world around. I should have the birds building their nests on my boughs, and when the wind blew, I should bow with stately dignity, like my tall companions." So discontented was the tree, that it took no pleasure in the warm sunshine, the birds, or the rosy clouds that floated over it morning and evening. Sometimes in winter, when the snow lay white and glittering on the ground, there was a little hare that would come springing along, and jump right over the little tree's head. Then how mortified it would feel. 2 winters passed, and when the third arrived, the tree had grown so tall that the hare was obliged to run round it. Yet it remained unsatisfied and would exclaim, "Oh, to grow, if I could but keep on growing tall and old. There is nothing else worth caring for in the world." In the autumn, the woodcutters came, as usual, and cut down several of the tallest trees, and the young fir, which was now grown to a good, full height, shuddered as the noble trees fell to the earth with a crash. After the branches were lopped off, the trunks looked so slender and bare that they could scarcely be recognized. Then they were placed, one upon another, upon wagons and drawn by horses out of the forest. Where could they be going? What would become of them? The young fir tree wished very much to know. So in the spring, when the swallows and the storks came, it asked, "Do you know where those trees were taken? Did you meet them?" The swallows knew nothing. But the stork, after a little reflection, nodded his head and said, "Yes, I think I do. As I flew from Egypt, I met several new ships, and they had fine masts that smelled like fir." These must have been the trees. And I assure you they were stately. They sailed right gloriously. Oh, how I wish I were tall enough to go on the sea, said the fir tree. Tell me, what is this sea, and what does it look like? It would take too much time to explain, a great deal too much, said the stork, flying quickly away. Rejoice in thy youth, said the sunbeam. Rejoice in thy fresh growth and in the young life that is in thee. And the wind kissed the tree, and the dew watered it with tears, but the fir tree regarded them not. Star, 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 Christmas time drew near, and many young trees were cut down, some that were even smaller and younger than the fir tree, who enjoyed neither rest nor peace for longing to leave its forest home. These young trees, which were chosen for their beauty, kept their branches, and they, also, were laid on wagons and drawn by horses far away out of the forest. Where are they going? Asked the fir tree. They are not taller than I am. Indeed, one is not so tall. And why do they keep all their branches? Where are they going? We know, sang the sparrows. We have looked in at the windows of the houses in the town, and we know what is done with them. Oh, you cannot think what honor and glory they receive. They are dressed up in the most splendid manner. We have seen them standing in the middle of a warm room, and adorned with all sorts of beautiful things, honey cakes, gilded apples, playthings, and many hundreds of wax tapers. And then, asked the fir tree, trembling in all its branches, and then what happens? We did not see any more, said the sparrows. But this was enough for us. I wonder whether anything so brilliant will ever happen to me, thought the fir tree. It would be better even than crossing the sea. I long for it almost with pain. Oh, when will Christmas be here? I am now as tall and well grown as those which were taken away last year. Oh, that I were now laid on the wagon, or standing in the warm room with all that brightness and splendor around me. Something better and more beautiful is to come after, or the trees would not be so decked out. Yes, what follows will be grander and more splendid. What can it be? I am weary with longing. I scarcely know what it is that I feel. Rejoice in our love, said the air and the sunlight. Enjoy thine own bright life in the fresh air. But the tree would not rejoice, though it grew taller every day, and winter and summer its dark green foliage might be seen in the forest, while passers-by would say, what a beautiful tree. A short time before the next Christmas, the discontented fir tree was the first to fall. As the axe cut sharply through the stem and divided the pith, the tree fell with a groan to the earth, conscious of pain and faintness and forgetting all its dreams of happiness and sorrow at leaving its home in the forest. It knew that it should never again see its dear old companions, the trees, nor the little bushes and many-colored flowers that had grown by its side. Perhaps not even the birds. Nor was the journey at all pleasant. The tree first recovered itself while being unpacked in the courtyard of a house, with several other trees. And it heard a man say, we only want one, and this is the prettiest. This is beautiful. Then came two servants in grand livery and carried the fir tree into a large and beautiful apartment. Pictures hung on the walls, and near the tall tile stove stood great china vases with lions on the lids. There were rocking chairs, silken sofas, and large tables covered with pictures. And there were books, and playthings that had cost 100 times $100, at least so said the children. Then the fir tree was placed in a large tub full of sand, but green baize hung all round it so that no one could know it was a tub, and it stood on a very handsome carpet. Oh, how the fir tree trembled! What was going to happen to him now? Some young ladies came, and the servants helped them to adorn the tree. On one branch they hung little bags cut out of colored paper, and each bag was filled with sweetmeats. From other branches hung gilded apples and walnuts, as if they had grown there. And above and all around were hundreds of red, blue, and white tapers, which were fastened upon the branches. Dolls, exactly like real men and women, were placed under the green leaves. The tree had never seen such things before, and at the very top was fastened a glittering star made of gold tinsel. Oh, it was very beautiful. This evening, they all exclaimed, how bright it will be. Oh, that the evening were come, thought the tree, and the tapers lighted. Then I shall know what else is going to happen. Will the trees of the forest come to see me? Will the sparrows peep in at the windows, I wonder, as they fly? Shall I grow faster here than in the forest, and shall I keep on all these ornaments during summer and winter? But guessing was of very little use. His back ached with trying, and this pain is as bad for a slender fir tree as headache is for us. At last the tapers were lighted, and then what a glistening blaze of splendor the tree presented. It trembled so with joy in all its branches that one of the candles fell among the green leaves and burned some of them. Help! Help! Exclaimed the young ladies. But no harm was done, for they quickly extinguished the fire. After this the tree tried not to tremble at all, though the fire frightened him. He was so anxious not to hurt any of the beautiful ornaments, even while their brilliancy dazzled him. And now the folding doors were thrown open, and a troop of children rushed in as if they intended to upset the tree, and were followed more slowly by their elders. For a moment the little ones stood silent with astonishment, and then they shouted for joy till the room rang, and they danced merrily round the tree while one present after another was taken from it. What are they doing? What will happen next? Thought the tree. At last the candles burned down to the branches and were put out. Then the children received permission to plunder the tree. Oh, how they rushed upon it. There was such a riot that the branches cracked, and had it not been fastened with a glistening star to the ceiling, it must have been thrown down. Then the children danced about with their pretty toys, and no one noticed the tree except the children's maid, who came and peeped among the branches to see if an apple or a fig had been forgotten. Star, 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 a story, cried the children, pulling a little fat man towards the tree. Now we shall be in the green shade, said the man as he seated himself under it, and the tree will have the pleasure of hearing, also. But I shall only relate one story. What shall it be? If Ada Vedor Humpty Dumpty, who fell downstairs, but soon got up again, and at last married a princess. If Ada Ved, cried some. Humpty Dumpty, cried others. And there was a famous uproar. But the fir tree remained quite still and thought to himself, shall I have anything to do with all this? Ought I to make a noise, too? But he had already amused them as much as they wished, and they paid no attention to him. Then the old man told them the story of Humpty Dumpty, how he fell downstairs, and was raised up again, and married a princess. And the children clapped their hands and cried, tell another, for they wanted to hear the story of Ivedavid. But this time they had only Humpty Dumpty. After this the fir tree became quite silent and thoughtful. Never had the birds in the forest told such tales as that of Humpty Dumpty, who fell downstairs, and yet married a princess. Ah, yes. So it happens in the world, thought the fir tree. He believed it all, because it was related by such a pleasant man. Ah, well, he thought, who knows? Perhaps I may fall down, too, and marry a princess. And he looked forward joyfully to the next evening, expecting to be again decked out with lights and playthings, gold and fruit. Tomorrow I will not tremble, thought he. I will enjoy all my splendor, and I shall hear the story of Humpty Dumpty again, and perhaps of Ivedavid. And the tree remained quiet and thoughtful all night. In the morning the servants and the housemaid came in. Now, thought the fir tree, all my splendor is going to begin again. But they dragged him out of the room and upstairs to the garret and threw him on the floor in a dark corner where no daylight shone, and there they left him. What does this mean? Thought the tree. What am I to do here? I can hear nothing in a place like this. And he leaned against the wall and thought and thought. And he had time enough to think. 4 days and nights passed and no one came near him. And when at last somebody did come, it was only to push away some large boxes in a corner. So the tree was completely hidden from sight, as if it had never existed. Illustration, threw him on the floor, and there they left him. It is winter now, thought the tree. The ground is hard and covered with snow, so that people cannot plant me. I shall be sheltered here, I dare say, until spring comes. How thoughtful and kind everybody is to me. Still, I wish this place were not so dark and so dreadfully lonely, with not even a little hare to look at. How pleasant it was out in the forest while the snow lay on the ground, when the hare would run by, yes, and jump over me, too, although I did not like it then. Oh, it is terribly lonely here. Squeak, squeak, said a little mouse, creeping cautiously towards the tree. Then came another, and they both sniffed at the fir tree and crept in and out between the branches. Oh, it is very cold, said the little mouse. If it were not, we should be very comfortable here, shouldn't we, old fir tree? I am not old, said the fir tree. There are many who are older than I am. Where do you come from? Asked the mice, who were full of curiosity. And what do you know? Have you seen the most beautiful places in the world, and can you tell us all about them? And have you been in the storeroom, where cheeses lie on the shelf and hams hang from the ceiling? One can run about on tallow candles there. One can go in thin and come out fat. I know nothing of that, said the fir tree, but I know the wood, where the sun shines and the birds sing. And then the tree told the little mice all about its youth. They had never heard such an account in their lives. And after they had listened to it attentively, they said, what a number of things you have seen. You must have been very happy. Happy! Exclaimed the fir tree. And then, as he reflected on what he had been telling them, he said, ah, yes. After all, those were happy days. But when he went on and related all about Christmas Eve, and how he had been dressed up with cakes and lights, the mice said, how happy you must have been, you old fir tree. I am not old at all, replied the tree. I only came from the forest this winter. I am now checked in my growth. What splendid stories you can tell, said the little mice. And the next night 4 other mice came with them to hear what the tree had to tell. The more he talked, the more he remembered, and then he thought to himself, yes, those were happy days. But they may come again. Humpty Dumpty fell downstairs, and yet he married the princess. Perhaps I may marry a princess, too. And the fir tree thought of the pretty little birch tree that grew in the forest. A real princess, a beautiful princess, she was to him. Who was Humpty Dumpty? Asked the little mice. And then the tree related the whole story. He could remember every single word. And the little mice were so delighted with it that they were ready to jump to the top of the tree. The next night a great many more mice made their appearance, and on Sunday 2 rats came with them. But the rats said it was not a pretty story at all, and the little mice were very sorry, for it made them also think less of it. Do you know only that one story? Asked the rats. Only that one, replied the fir tree. I heard it on the happiest evening in my life, but I did not know I was so happy at the time. We think it is a very miserable story, said the rats. Don't you know any story about bacon or tallow in the storeroom? No, replied the tree. Many thanks to you, then, replied the rats, and they went their ways. The little mice also kept away after this, and the tree sighed and said, It was very pleasant when the merry little mice sat round me and listened while I talked. Now that is all past, too. However, I shall consider myself happy when someone comes to take me out of this place. But would this ever happen? Yes. One morning people came to clear up the garret. The boxes were packed away, and the tree was pulled out of the corner and thrown roughly on the floor. Then the servants dragged it out upon the staircase, where the daylight shone. Now life is beginning again, said the tree, rejoicing in the sunshine and fresh air. Then it was carried downstairs and taken into the courtyard so quickly that it forgot to think of itself and could only look about. There was so much to be seen. The court was close to a garden, where everything looked blooming. Fresh and fragrant roses hung over the little palings. The linden trees were in blossom, while swallows flew here and there, crying, Twit, 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 my mate is coming. But it was not the fir tree they meant. Now I shall live, cried the tree joyfully, spreading out its branches. But alas! They were all withered and yellow, and it lay in a corner among weeds and nettles. The star of gold paper still stuck in the top of the tree and glittered in the sunshine. Two of the merry children who had danced round the tree at Christmas and had been so happy were playing in the same courtyard. The youngest saw the gilded star and ran and pulled it off the tree. Look what is sticking to the ugly old fir tree, said the child, treading on the branches till they crackled under his boots. And the tree saw all the fresh, bright flowers in the garden and then looked at itself and wished it had remained in the dark corner of the garret. It thought of its fresh youth in the forest, of the merry Christmas evening, and of the little mice who had listened to the story of Humpty Dumpty. Past, past, said the poor tree. Oh, had I but enjoyed myself while I could have done so. But now it is too late. Then a lad came and chopped the tree into small pieces, till a large bundle lay in a heap on the ground. The pieces were placed in a fire, and they quickly blazed up brightly, while the tree sighed so deeply that each sigh was like a little pistol shot. Then the children who were at play came and seated themselves in front of the fire, and looked at it and cried, Pop, pop. But at each pop, which was a deep sigh, the tree was thinking of a summer day in the forest or of some winter night there when the stars shone brightly, and of Christmas evening, and of Humpty Dumpty, the only story it had ever heard or knew how to relate, till at last it was consumed. The boy still played in the garden, and the youngest wore on his breast the golden star with which the tree had been adorned during the happiest evening of its existence. Now all was past. The tree's life was past and the story also past, for all stories must come to an end at some time or other. Illustration, little T.U.K. An odd name, to be sure. However, it was not the little boy's real name. His real name was Carl. But when he was so young that he could not speak plainly, he used to call himself Tuck. It would be hard to say why, for it is not at all like Carl. But the name does as well as any, if one only knows it. Little Tuck was left at home to take care of his sister Gustava, who was much younger than himself, and he had also to learn his lesson. Here were two things to be done at the same time, and they did not at all suit each other. The poor boy sat with his sister in his lap, singing to her all the songs he knew, yet giving, now and then, a glance into his geography, which lay open beside him. By tomorrow morning he must know the names of all the towns in Sealand by heart, and be able to tell about them all that could be told. His mother came at last, and took little Gustava in her arms. Tuck ran quickly to the window and read till he had almost read his eyes out, for it was growing dark, and his mother could not afford to buy candles. There goes the old washerwoman down the lane, said the mother, as she looked out of the window. She can hardly drag herself along, poor thing, and now she has to carry that heavy pail from the pump. Be a good boy, little Tuck, and run across to help the poor creature, will you not? And little Tuck ran quickly and helped to bear the weight of the pail. But when he came back into the room, it was quite dark. Nothing was said about a candle, and it was of no use to wish for one. He must go to his little trundle bed, which was made of an old settle. There he lay, still thinking of the geography lesson, of Sealand, and of all that the master had said. He could not read the book again, as he should by rights have done, for want of a light. So he put the geography book under his pillow. Somebody had once told him that would help him wonderfully to remember his lesson, but he had never yet found that one could depend upon it. There he lay and thought, till all at once he felt as though someone were gently sealing his mouth and eyes with a kiss. He slept and yet did not sleep, for he seemed to see the old washerwoman's mild, kind eyes fixed upon him, and to hear her say, It would be a shame, indeed, for you not to know your lesson tomorrow, little Tuck. You helped me. Now I will help you, and our Lord will help us both. All at once the leaves of the book began to rustle under little 2K's head, and he heard something crawling about under his pillow. "Cluck, cluck, cluck," cried a hen, as she crept towards him. She came from the town of Kyog. "I'm a Kyog hen," she said. And then she told him how many inhabitants the little town contained, and about the battle that had once been fought there, and how it was now hardly worth mentioning. There were so many greater things. Illustration: all in a moment he was on horseback, and on he went, gallop, gallop, scratch, scratch. Cribbly Cradley. And now a great wooden bird jumped down upon the bed. It was the popinjay from the shooting ground at Preisto. He had reckoned the number of inhabitants in Preisto, and found that there were as many as he had nails in his body. He was a proud bird. Thorwaldsen lived in one corner of Preisto, close by me. Am I not a pretty bird, a merry popinjay? And now little Tuck no longer lay in bed. All in a moment he was on horseback, and on he went, gallop, gallop. A splendid knight, with a bright helmet and waving plume, a knight of the olden time, held him on his own horse. And on they rode together, through the wood of the ancient city of Vordingborg, and it was once again a great and busy town. The high towers of the king's castle rose against the sky, and bright lights were seen gleaming through the windows. Within were music and merrymaking. King Waldemar was leading out the noble ladies of his court to dance with him. Suddenly the morning dawned, the lamps grew pale, the sun rose, the outlines of the buildings faded away, and at last one high tower alone remained to mark the spot where the royal castle had stood. The vast city had shrunk into a poor, mean-looking little town. The schoolboys, coming out of school with their geography books under their arms, said, 2,000 inhabitants. But that was a mere boast, for the town had not nearly so many. And little Tuck lay in his bed. He knew not whether he had been dreaming or not, but again there was someone close by his side. "Little Tuck! Little Tuck!" cried a voice. It was the voice of a young sailor boy. "I am come to bring you greeting from Corsair. Corsair is a new town, a living town, with steamers and mail coaches. Once people used to call it a low, ugly place, but they do so no longer. I dwell by the seaside," says Corsair. "I have brought high roads and pleasure gardens, and I have given birth to a poet, a witty one, too, which is more than all poets are. I once thought of sending a ship all round the world, but I did not do it, though I might as well have done so. I dwell so pleasantly, close by the port, and I am fragrant with perfume, for the loveliest roses bloom round about me, close to my gates." And little Tuck could smell the roses and see them in their fresh green leaves. But in a moment they had vanished. The green leaves spread and thickened, a perfect grove had grown up above the bright waters of the bay, and above the grove rose the two high-pointed towers of a glorious old church. From the side of the grass-grown hill gushed a fountain and rainbowy geoid streams, with a merry, musical voice, and close beside it sat a king, wearing a gold crown upon his long dark hair. This was King Roar of the Springs. And hard by was the town of Roskilde, Roar's fountain. And up the hill, on a broad highway, went all the kings and queens of Denmark, wearing golden crowns. Hand in hand they passed on into the church, and the deep music of the organ mingled with the clear rippling of the fountain. For nearly all the kings and queens of Denmark lie buried in this beautiful church. And little Tuck saw and heard it all. "Don't forget the towns," said King Roar. Then all vanished, though where it went he knew not. It seemed like turning the leaves of a book. And now there stood before him an old peasant woman from Sorrow, the quiet little town where grass grows in the very marketplace. Her green linen apron was thrown over her head and back, and the apron was very wet, as if it had been raining heavily. "And so it has," she said. And she told a great many pretty things from Holberg's comedies, and recited ballads about Waldemar and Absalon, for Holberg had founded an academy in her native town. All at once she cowered down and rocked her head as if she were a frog about to spring. "Coax!" cried she. "It is wet, it is always wet, and it is as still as the grave in Sorrow." She had changed into a frog. "Coax!" And again she was an old woman. "One must dress according to the weather," she said. "It is wet. It is wet. My native town is like a bottle. One goes in at the cork, and by the cork one must come out. In old times we had the finest of fish. Now we have fresh, rosy-cheeked boys at the bottom of the bottle. There they learn wisdom, Greek, Greek, and Hebrew. Coax, it sounded exactly as if frogs were croaking, or as if someone were walking over the great swamp with heavy boots. So tiresome was her tone, all on the same note, that little Tuck fell fast asleep. And a very good thing it was for him. But even in sleep there came a dream, or whatever else it may be called. His little sister Gustava, with her blue eyes and flaxen ringlets, was grown into a tall, beautiful girl, who, though she had no wings, could fly. And away they now flew over Sealand, over its green woods and blue waters. "Hark! Do you hear the cock crow, little Tuck? Cock-a-doodle-doo. The fowls are flying hither from Kyog, and you shall have a farmyard, a great, great poultry yard of your own. You shall never suffer hunger or want. The golden goose, the bird of good omen, shall be yours. You shall become a rich and happy man. Your house shall rise up like King Waldemar's towers and be richly decked with statues like those of Thorwaldsen at Preisto. Understand me well. Your good name shall be borne round the world, like the ship that was to sail from Corsair, and at Roskilde you shall speak and give counsel wisely and well, little talk, like King Ra'or. And when at last you shall lie in your peaceful grave, you shall sleep as quietly, as if I lay sleeping in sorrow, said Tok, and he woke. It was a bright morning, and he could not remember his dream, but it was not necessary that he should. One has no need to know what one will live to see. And now he sprang quickly out of bed and sought his book, that had lain under his pillow. He read his lesson and found that he knew the towns perfectly well. And the old washerwoman put her head in at the door and said, with a friendly nod, thank you, my good child, for yesterday's help. May the Lord fulfill your brightest and most beautiful dreams. I know he will. Little Tuck had forgotten what he had dreamed, but it did not matter. There was one above who knew it all. Illustration: The Ugly Duckling. It was so beautiful in the country. It was the summertime. The wheat fields were golden, the oats were green, and the hay stood in great stacks in the green meadows. The stork paraded about among them on his long red legs, chattering away in Egyptian, the language he had learned from his lady mother. All around the meadows and cornfields grew thick woods, and in the midst of the forest was a deep lake. Yes, it was beautiful, it was delightful in the country. In a sunny spot stood a pleasant old farmhouse circled all about with deep canals, and from the walls down to the water's edge grew great burdocks, so high that under the tallest of them a little child might stand upright. The spot was as wild as if it had been in the very center of the thick wood. In this snug retreat sat a duck upon her nest, watching for her young brood to hatch. But the pleasure she had felt at first was almost gone. She had begun to think it a wearisome task, for the little ones were so long coming out of their shells, and she seldom had visitors. The other ducks liked much better to swim about in the canals than to climb the slippery banks and sit under the burdock leaves to have a gossip with her. It was a long time to stay so much by herself. At length, however, one shell cracked, and soon another, and from each came a living creature that lifted its head and cried, "Peep, peep." "Quack, quack," said the mother. And then they all tried to say it, too, as well as they could, while they looked all about them on every side at the tall green leaves. Their mother allowed them to look about as much as they liked, because green is good for the eyes. "What a great world it is, to be sure," said the little ones, when they found how much more room they had than when they were in the eggshell. "Is this all the world, do you imagine?" said the mother. "Wait till you have seen the garden. Far beyond that it stretches down to the pastor's field, though I have never ventured to such a distance. Are you all out?" she continued, rising to look. "No, not all. The largest egg lies there yet, I declare. I wonder how long this business is to last. I'm really beginning to be tired of it." But for all that, she sat down again. "Well, and how are you today?" quacked an old duck who came to pay her a visit. "There's one egg that takes a deal of hatching. The shell is hard and will not break," said the fond mother, who sat still upon her nest. "But just look at the others. Have I not a pretty family? Are they not the prettiest little ducklings you ever saw? They are the image of their father, the good for naught. He never comes to see me." "Let me see the egg that will not break," said the old duck. "I've no doubt it's a guinea fowl's egg. The same thing happened to me once, and a deal of trouble it gave me, for the young ones are afraid of the water. I quacked and clucked, but all to no purpose. Let me take a look at it. Yes, I am right. It's a guinea fowl, upon my word. So take my advice and leave it where it is. Come to the water and teach the other children to swim." "I think I will sit a little while longer," said the mother. "I have sat so long, a day or two more won't matter." "Very well, please yourself," said the old duck, rising. And she went away. Star, 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 at last the great egg broke, and the latest bird cried, "Peep, peep," as he crept forth from the shell. How big and ugly he was! The mother duck stared at him and did not know what to think. "Really," she said, "this is an enormous duckling, and it is not at all like any of the others. I wonder if he will turn out to be a guinea fowl. Well, we shall see when we get to the water, for into the water he must go, even if I have to push him in myself." On the next day the weather was delightful. The sun shone brightly on the green burdock leaves, and the mother duck took her whole family down to the water and jumped in with a splash. "Quack, quack," cried she, and one after another the little ducklings jumped in. The water closed over their heads, but they came up again in an instant and swam about quite prettily, with their legs paddling under them as easily as possible. Their legs went of their own accord, and the ugly gray coat was also in the water, swimming with them. "Oh," said the mother, "that is not a guinea fowl. See how well he uses his legs, and how erect he holds himself. He is my own child, and he is not so very ugly after all, if you look at him properly. Quack, quack. Come with me now. I will take you into grand society and introduce you to the farmyard, but you must keep close to me or you may be trodden upon. And, above all, beware of the cat." When they reached the farmyard, there was a wretched riot going on. Two families were fighting for an eel's head, which, after all, was carried off by the cat. "See, children, That is the way of the world, said the mother duck, wetting her beak, for she would have liked Eel's head herself. Come, now, use your legs, and let me see how well you can behave. You must bow your heads prettily to that old duck yonder. She is the highest born of them all and has Spanish blood. Therefore she is well off. Don't you see she has a red rag tied to her leg, which is something very grand and a great honor for a duck. It shows that everyone is anxious not to lose her, and that she is to be noticed by both man and beast. Come, now, don't turn in your toes. A well-bred duckling spreads his feet wide apart, just like his father and mother, in this way. Now bend your necks and say, quack. The ducklings did as they were bad, but the other ducks stared, and said, look, here comes another brood, as if there were not enough of us already. And bless me, what a queer-looking object one of them is. We don't want him here. And then one flew out and bit him in the neck. Let him alone, said the mother. He is not doing any harm. Yes, but he is so big and ugly. He's a perfect fright, said the spiteful duck, and therefore he must be turned out. A little biting will do him good. The others are very pretty children, said the old duck with the rag on her leg, all but that one. I wish his mother could smooth him up a bit. He is really ill-favored. That is impossible, your grace, replied the mother. He is not pretty, but he has a very good disposition and swims as well as the others or even better. I think he will grow up pretty, and perhaps be smaller. He has remained too long in the egg, and therefore his figure is not properly formed. And then she stroked his neck and smoothed the feathers, saying, it is a drake, and therefore not of so much consequence. I think he will grow up strong and able to take care of himself. The other ducklings are graceful enough, said the old duck. Now make yourself at home, and if you find an eel's head you can bring it to me. And so they made themselves comfortable. But the poor duckling who had crept out of his shell last of all and looked so ugly was bitten and pushed and made fun of, not only by the ducks but by all the poultry. Illustration, bless me, what a queer-looking object one of them is. He is too big, they all said. And the turkey cock, who had been born into the world with spurs and fancied himself really an emperor, puffed himself out like a vessel in full sail and flew at the duckling. He became quite red in the head with passion, so that the poor little thing did not know where to go, and was quite miserable because he was so ugly as to be laughed at by the whole farmyard. So it went on from day to day. It got worse and worse. The poor duckling was driven about by everyone. Even his brothers and sisters were unkind to him and would say, ah, you ugly creature, I wish the cat would get you, and his mother had been heard to say she wished he had never been born. The ducks pecked him, the chickens beat him, and the girl who fed the poultry pushed him with her feet. So at last he ran away, frightening the little birds in the hedge as he flew over the palings. They are afraid because I am so ugly, he said. So he flew still farther, until he came out on a large moor inhabited by wild ducks. Here he remained the whole night, feeling very sorrowful. In the morning, when the wild ducks rose in the air, they stared at their new comrade. What sort of a duck are you? They all said, coming round him. He bowed to them and was as polite as he could be, but he did not reply to their question. You are exceedingly ugly, said the wild ducks. But that will not matter if you do not want to marry one of our family. Poor thing. He had no thoughts of marriage. All he wanted was permission to lie among the rushes and drink some of the water on the moor. After he had been on the moor 2 days, there came 2 wild geese, or rather goslings, for they had not been out of the egg long, which accounts for their impertinence. Listen, friend, said one of them to the duckling. You are so ugly that we like you very well. Will you go with us and become a bird of passage? Not far from here is another moor, in which there are some wild geese, all of them unmarried. It is a chance for you to get a wife. You may make your fortune, ugly as you are. Bang, bang, sounded in the air, and the 2 wild geese fell dead among the rushes, and the water was tinged with blood. Bang, bang, echoed far and wide in the distance, and whole flocks of wild geese rose up from the rushes. The sound continued from every direction, for the sportsmen surrounded the moor, and some were even seated on branches of trees, overlooking the rushes. The blue smoke from the guns rose like clouds over the dark trees, and as it floated away across the water, a number of sporting dogs bounded in among the rushes, which bent beneath them wherever they went. How they terrified the poor duckling! He turned away his head to hide it under his wing, and at the same moment a large, terrible dog passed quite near him. His jaws were open, his tongue hung from his mouth, and his eyes glared fearfully. He thrust his nose close to the duckling, showing his sharp teeth, and then, splash, splash, he went into the water, without touching him. Oh, sighed the duckling, how thankful I am for being so ugly. Even a dog will not bite me. And so he lay quite still, while the shot rattled through the rushes, and gun after gun was fired over him. It was late in the day before all became quiet, but even then the poor young thing did not dare to move. He waited quietly for several hours and then, after looking carefully around him, hastened away from the moor as fast as he could. He ran over field and meadow till a storm arose, and he could hardly struggle against it. Towards evening he reached a poor little cottage that seemed ready to fall, and only seemed to remain standing because it could not decide on which side to fall first. The storm continued so violent that the duckling could go no farther. He sat down by the cottage, and then he noticed that the door was not quite closed, in consequence of one of the hinges having given way. There was, therefore, a narrow opening near the bottom large enough for him to slip through, which he did very quietly, and got to shelter for the night. Here, in this cottage, lived a woman, a cat, and a hen. The cat, whom his mistress called my little son, was a great favorite. He could raise his back, and purr, and could even throw out sparks from his fur if it were stroked the wrong way. The hen had very short legs, so she was called Chicky Short Legs. She laid good eggs, and her mistress loved her as if she had been her own child. In the morning the strange visitor was discovered. The cat began to purr and the hen to cluck. "What is that noise about?" said the old woman, looking around the room. But her sight was not very good. Therefore when she saw the duckling she thought it must be a fat duck that had strayed from home. "Oh, what a prize!" she exclaimed. "I hope it is not a drake, for then I shall have some duck's eggs. I must wait and see." So the duckling was allowed to remain on trial for 3 weeks. But there were no eggs. Now the cat was the master of the house, and the hen was the mistress. And they always said, "We and the world," for they believed themselves to be half the world, and by far the better half, too. The duckling thought that others might hold a different opinion on the subject, but the hen would not listen to such doubts. "Can you lay eggs?" she asked. "No." "Then have the goodness to cease talking. Can you raise your back, or purr, or throw out sparks?" said the cat. "No." "Then you have no right to express an opinion when sensible people are speaking." So the duckling sat in a corner, feeling very low-spirited. But when the sunshine and the fresh air came into the room through the open door, he began to feel such a great longing for a swim that he could not help speaking of it. "What an absurd idea," said the hen. "You have nothing else to do. Therefore you have foolish fancies. If you could purr or lay eggs, they would pass away." "But it is so delightful to swim about on the water," said the duckling, "and so refreshing to feel it close over your head while you dive down to the bottom." "Delightful, indeed. It must be a queer sort of pleasure," said the hen. "Why, you must be crazy. Ask the cat, he is the cleverest animal I know. Ask him how he would like to swim about on the water, or to dive under it, for I will not speak of my own opinion. Ask our mistress, the old woman. There is no one in the world more clever than she is. Do you think she would relish swimming and letting the water close over her head?" "I see you don't understand me," said the duckling. "We don't understand you? Who can understand you, I wonder? Do you consider yourself more clever than the cat or the old woman? I will say nothing of myself. Don't imagine such nonsense, child, and thank your good fortune that you have been so well received here. Are you not in a warm room and in society from which you may learn something? But you are a chatterer, and your company is not very agreeable. Believe me, I speak only for your good. I may tell you unpleasant truths, but that is a proof of my friendship. I advise you, therefore, to lay eggs and learn to purr as quickly as possible." "I believe I must go out into the world again," said the duckling. "Yes, do," said the hen. So the duckling left the cottage and soon found water on which it could swim and dive, but he was avoided by all other animals because of his ugly appearance. Autumn came, and the leaves in the forest turned to orange and gold. Then, as winter approached, the wind caught them as they fell and whirled them into the cold air. The clouds, heavy with hail and snowflakes, hung low in the sky, and the raven stood among the reeds, crying, "Croak, croak." It made one shiver with cold to look at him. All this was very sad for the poor little duckling. One evening, just as the sun was setting amid radiant clouds, there came a large flock of beautiful birds out of the bushes. The duckling had never seen any like them before. They were swans, and they curved their graceful necks, while their soft plumage shone with dazzling whiteness. They uttered a singular cry as they spread their glorious wings and flew away from those cold regions to warmer countries across the sea. They mounted higher and higher in the air, and the ugly little duckling had a strange sensation as he watched them. He whirled himself in the water like a wheel, stretched out his neck toward them, and uttered a cry so strange that it frightened even himself. Could he ever forget those beautiful, happy birds? And when at last they were out of his sight, he dived under the water and rose again almost beside himself with excitement. He knew not the names of these birds nor where they had flown, but he felt towards them as he had never felt towards any other bird in the world. He was not envious of these beautiful creatures. It never occurred to him to wish to be as lovely as they. Poor ugly creature, how gladly he would have lived even with the ducks, had they only treated him kindly and given him encouragement. The winter grew colder and colder. He was obliged to swim about on the water to keep it from freezing, but every night the space on which he swam became smaller and smaller. At length it froze so hard that the ice in the water crackled as he moved, and the duckling had to paddle with his legs as well as he could, to keep the space from closing up. He became exhausted at last and lay still and helpless, frozen fast in the ice. Early in the morning a peasant who was passing by saw what had happened. He broke the ice in pieces with his wooden shoe and carried the duckling home to his wife. The warmth revived the poor little creature, but when the children wanted to play with him, the duckling thought they would do him some harm, so he started up in terror, fluttered into the milk pan, and splashed the milk about the room. Then the woman clapped her hands, which frightened him still more. He flew first into the butter cask, then into the meal tub and out again. What a condition he was in! The woman screamed and struck at him with the tongs. The children laughed and screamed and tumbled over each other in their efforts to catch him, but luckily he'd escaped. The door stood open. The poor creature could just manage to slip out among the bushes and lie down quite exhausted in the newly fallen snow. It would be very sad were I to relate all the misery and privations which the poor little duckling endured during the hard winter. But when it had passed, he found himself lying one morning in a moor, amongst the rushes. He felt the warm sun shining and heard the lark singing and saw that all around was beautiful spring. Then the young bird felt that his wings were strong, as he flapped them against his sides and rose high into the air. They bore him onwards until, before he well knew how it had happened, he found himself in a large garden. The apple trees were in full blossom, and the fragrant alders bent their long green branches down to the stream, which wound round a smooth lawn. Everything looked beautiful in the freshness of early spring. From a thicket close by came three beautiful white swans, rustling their feathers and swimming lightly over the smooth water. The duckling saw these lovely birds and felt more strangely unhappy than ever. "I will fly to these royal birds," he exclaimed, "and they will kill me because, ugly as I am, I dare to approach them. But it does not matter. Better be killed by them than pecked by the ducks, beaten by the hens, pushed about by the maiden who feeds the poultry, or starved with hunger in the winter." Then he flew to the water and swam toward the beautiful swans. The moment they espied the stranger, they rushed to meet him with outstretched wings. "Kill me," said the poor bird, and he bent his head down to the surface of the water and away to death. But what did he see in the clear stream below? His own image, no longer a dark gray bird, ugly and disagreeable to look at, but a graceful and beautiful swan. To be born in a duck's nest in a farmyard is of no consequence to a bird if it is hatched from a swan's egg. He now felt glad at having suffered sorrow and trouble, because it enabled him to enjoy so much better all the pleasure and happiness around him. For the great swan swam round the newcomer and stroked his neck with their beaks, as a welcome. Into the garden present became some little children and threw bread and cake into the water. "Illustration, the new one is the most beautiful of all, see," cried the youngest, "there is a new one." And the rest were delighted, and ran to their father and mother, dancing and clapping their hands and shouting joyously, "There is another swan come! A new one has arrived!" Then they threw more bread and cake into the water and said, "The new one is the most beautiful of all, he is so young and pretty." And the old swans bowed their heads before him. Then he felt quite ashamed and hid his head under his wing, for he did not know what to do. He was so happy, yet he was not at all proud. He had been persecuted and despised for his ugliness, and now he heard them say he was the most beautiful of all the birds. Even the elder tree bent down its boughs into the water before him, and the sun shone warm and bright. Then he rustled his feathers, curved his slender neck, and cried joyfully, from the depths of his heart, "I never dreamed of such happiness as this while I was the despised ugly duckling."